Welcome to Finance Connect's series of podcasts on the European asset finance industry. I'm Richard O'Donoghue, and throughout this year, I've been chatting to industry experts about the challenges and opportunities facing our industry in 2025 and beyond. Normally, our podcasts run to about 30 minutes, but I suspect that today may take a little longer, as I'm joined by an extremely well-known figure in our industry. Andrew Denton, CEO of Alpha Systems. Thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Great. So what I'd like to do today is focus really on three areas. First of all, maybe we can chat about your business and the trends that you're seeing in the market. And then maybe we can pivot to talk a little bit about your culture. And finally, given, you know, you're a very well-known figure in the industry, you've been in the industry for a long time, I'd love to talk a little bit about your career path and maybe get some insights for some of our younger listeners. So if we maybe start with your business, besides sponsoring our podcast, for which we're very grateful, what does Alpha do?
Alpha is a software and delivery company, essentially. So the easy bit to get your head around is the fact that we provide heart and lung software for asset and automotive finance companies. The software does everything. We do originations, we do servicing, wholesale, these days fleet and commercial lending as well, but very much focused on the sector audience for this podcast. We are very much focused on the asset finance market, and frankly, it's a big market. It spends about $3.5 billion on software related services every year. So from our perspective, that's plenty to go at. We do it internationally. We're very much a transatlantic company these days. A week or so ago, we started implementing in country number 38.
Wow.
So we are, we used to claim we were international, I think, when we did the UK and Australia and a little bit of Europe, but we do feel a lot like an international company. So the software's half of it, but as you very well know, Richard, that these are complicated business transformation projects. So the other side of the business is making sure that we affect these transformations reliably and safely for our customers, so that not only do they have the piece of software, but they're achieving what they want to achieve with the software.
And what you mentioned, transformation projects, what's sort of a typical case that you would encounter? And what does it entail to deliver a transformation project, and possibly how long does it take?
The piece of string question.
Yeah.
It kind of depends on the size of the organization that we're talking about. We deal with some monster companies, particularly in North America, in terms of volume. Our largest customer has got 9 million wheeled assets across wholesale and retail.
Wow.
And uses into the tens of thousands. And if I was in the office, I could be not a million miles away from waving at Nathan Mollett at United Trust, and they're very much at the other end of the spectrum. So it sort of depends on the size of the organization, and we take pride in being able to service all of them. But actually, there is something that brings all of these transformations together, in that we do our very best to deliver some form of business value pretty quickly, because obviously, these are big things, big endeavors, and you want to make sure that stakeholders have got something to see for them.
If you attend any Finance Connect conference, there's a lot of players in this space that will be there. How does Alpha differentiate itself from other players? What makes you unique?
We'll talk about culture and purpose a little bit later, you said, but you know, that is one of our superpowers, the fact that we try to create an organization and we try to create a space where people genuinely feel that they are doing something that has a purpose and they can be proud of. And that's a real edge. But the more tangible edge will be around the quality of our delivery. I've been doing it for 30 years. We as a business have been doing it for 35 years. We're all, and they don't let me code anymore, Richard, but I am a software engineer by training, and I have run the projects myself, and same applies to business development people. We all live and breathe this idea of value delivery for our customers. We also differentiate with the software itself. I've got a lot of cliches I use, and you may be exposed to a few of them in our conversation, but one of them I often say to investors is that I think it's important that you mend the roof while the sun shines. And by that, I mean investing in the software. Alpha is a is a true package solution. And look, there's definitely an approach to running a software business, which is along the lines of invest in the software and then sweat the heck out of it, which is great for your bottom line, but it means that you get an existential crisis and have to completely replatform or make an invasive change roughly once every 5 to 10 years. So we, by the end of this year, will probably have invested about 40 million sterling in taking our software forward this year. So we're constantly doing new stuff to it, constantly refreshing our technology so that there's no technical debt. And that level of investment is a real differentiating factor for us, I think.
I mean, it's an interesting point. If you look at your customer base, do they tend to mend the roof while the sun shines, or is it more the rain has arrived and or it's imminent that the rain is going to arrive and therefore they say, wow, we need to do this transformation now? What do you tend to see as the trend in the industry?
It's a really great question, Richard, and I'll turn that into the way that we look at it, which is push and pull factors. Because ultimately, these software solutions are really sticky if you do a good job. So why do people make that change? Pull factors are the kind of thing that AFC is discussing and shining a light on the whole time. The stuff like, this is automation, mobility, servitization, AI, decisioning, cloud, all of that stuff in terms of business competition and taking things forward. And that's sort of in the area of continuous improvement, even for step change exponential technologies like AI. Push factors, though, are really interesting. So without naming competitor names, if your supplier decides that they're going to withdraw support for the version of the software that you're using, that's a push factor. You've got absolutely no choice. What if, and you'd be surprised at this, about 1 billion plus of that 3.5 billion spent is spent on really old technology. And I mean 70s type mainframe technology. So that could be a cyber risk. It could be literally the people who can develop that for you are dying. And then sort of the one that does get a lot of attention at the AFC gatherings, regulation. And there's always change in our industries. You know, if there's a major piece of regulatory change, and a combination of factors means it's very difficult for you to get to the party with your existing software, then you've kind of got no choice. So to return to your metaphor, it really is chucking it down, and you've got to do something. But with our existing customers, we encourage them to upgrade frequently, stay at the bow wave of the software, and then they can avail themselves of all the new stuff that we're developing and hopefully adding value to their businesses.
I guess that's the value of the kind of SaaS model that you have, that customers are able to avail of that, and you're there to help them on the journey of ensuring they're up to date from a cyber point of view, from a regulatory point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you might be surprised that we will release a new version of a software every 4 weeks without fail. We've been doing that for over a decade and a half. And somebody will take that version of software and our customers will upgrade their software. And we've got some clever techniques that make it very upgradable. So they're able to make sure that they do stay in that position where they've got every chance of maintaining that regulatory compliance or availing themselves of exciting new stuff that like pay-per-use. SaaS is part of that, but having a single product, I spoke about the two ends of the spectrum of customer size and demand. Both of those organizations, in fact, every single one of our customers uses precisely the same piece of software. There is only one alpha. So everything we do goes into that. And it's that that really gives us the backbone for keeping everybody in that advanced position. SaaS is part of it. We are very keen on the idea of single tenant SaaS. We use automation techniques to make sure that we're as effective and efficient as possible there. But within the enterprise market and for large regulated businesses, we don't think that they're going to particularly appreciate waking up one frosty or stormy morning and their heart and lung software has been upgraded. So the level of resilience and regulatory comfort that we can give through single-tenant SaaS is a big deal for us as well.
Great. Well, before we geek out on SaaS, maybe let's pivot to something you mentioned earlier as a big differentiator. And it's something that, you know, when I look at your LinkedIn profile, for example, I see you talk a lot about values and principles at Alpha. Talk a little bit more about what are they?
We're very unusual as a listed business in that we can actually take our strategy and cut and paste it directly into our annual report. And I sometimes read annual reports and feel that doesn't happen. And for us, it's really important that people understand the why and the what of what they're doing. But as I said earlier, also being very proud of what you do. I think for us as an organization, everybody getting behind what we're about and what our vision is super important. So I said earlier that we're a software and delivery company. Our purpose is around making our customers future ready and doing that with great technology and diverse people. But as you grow, we're well over 500 people these days, it's really important that you create the capability to scale your culture. So we have four values: challenge without being challenging, let great ideas grow, create a positive impact, make it better together. And each of those is overloaded in terms of its significance in what it means to us, both internally and externally in the footprint that we have within the world and the communities in which we work. But for me, my job is to give people the opportunity to perform and to be as effective as they possibly can. So it's super important that decision makers everywhere within our business are able to see every micro and macro decision through the same lens that I would see it. And that's where values are super helpful. Culture is something that binds us together, and it's a very, very powerful feeling to have that strong culture, to have a relatively flat organization, to feel that we're all pulling in the same direction. And, you know, it's very, very difficult for somebody like me to create a great culture, Richard, but I do know that it's relatively easy as a leader to wreck it. And you and I have both seen that in our careers. So I spend a lot of time thinking about it.
And I mean, the principles in particular, first of all, were they difficult to initially come up with? And secondly, have they evolved much over time?
I think they sort of evolved naturally, to be honest. But look, on the subject of cliches, one of the things that I often talk about is the idea of the journey being as important as the destination, whether that's in innovation or defining your values. So I think the important thing in having values is not just that lens for decision making and behaviors within the business, but also having something that we talk about a lot. That means that we're constantly thinking about our values, constantly stretching our values and thinking about preserving them. So our vision is to have a small company feel, to feel like that extended family, and a big company impact. And we're actually going through a process at the moment where we've polled everybody and said, okay, what are the small company feels that you value, and what are the big company impacts that you feel would be beneficial to us? And that's an ongoing dialogue with the organization right now to ensure that we're able to scale those values and scale our culture into the next stage. And I guess that's the thing, constant dialogue. Everything, I hate this idea that there are so many things that companies see as point in time events. Let's bring everybody together for a strategy discussion twice a year. Let's have an innovation day. Let's talk about our values, and then let's stick them in the fire safe and forget about them. All of these things are continuous processes in great organizations. I feel really strongly about that.
So maybe let's talk about practicalities, because it's you've kind of alluded to it. It's great to have these values, but often big project groups get together, they come up with the values, the principles, and then they sit on the shelf, and maybe they're on your screensaver, or maybe at an all hands they get produced. But what do they mean in practice? And one thing, or one of the principles you have, is you mentioned let great ideas grow. What does that mean in practice?
That means in practice, let's not stifle critical thinking and innovation. So a lot of what we do, and in fact, what I think my job is as a leader, is this idea of servant leadership, is again creating that environment to make sure that I can get the absolute best out of the crazy levels of talent and free thinking that we have in the organization. So letting great ideas grow is exactly about that. Let's be able to harvest good ideas, critical thinking, innovation from all parts of the industry, and all parts of the business rather. And implicit within your question is, I think you're asking, how do you walk the walk as opposed to talk the talk? So letting great ideas grow is probably best personified in our hackathons. So we have innovation afternoons throughout the year, and that culminates in two hackathons within each of our territories every year. What's a hackathon? Well, you bring everybody together, and you have ideas. I am going to invoke that cliche again. It's such an important journey of collaboration and working together, and we'll get great ideas out of the end of it. But the key thing is to make sure that you don't restrain it. If people are collaborating and thinking about something and it's a fail fast, so be it. We get great software out of it. We've released 10 new modules of the software in 2025, and some of them came from the hackathon. But it's making sure that you put people in a position where they can ideate and innovate. Essentially, we're harvesting the talent that we've got and being in a position where we can have a lot of fun out of it. And you were talking about geeking it up earlier. I think the key to the hackathon is making sure that everybody's included. So it's not just people engineering cool new software and technologies. It could be going and spending some time in a mindfulness garden that's local to our community and making sure that that's the best it can be. The folks in finance thinking about how we can do a better job of invoicing our customers. It really does need to be very, very inclusive.
Well, you've mentioned the word inclusive twice, so it kind of leads to the next principle, which is creating a positive impact. And I suppose it's become a politicized discussion around particularly DEI elements, but just in general, positive impact, ESG, use whatever acronym you want. But you've been very sort of strong, I'd say, at remaining committed to that. Again, maybe talk to us a little bit about why that remains important for you.
I don't really see any of it as being particularly optional. I don't see how you can be a great business and not be inclusive. But both as a human being, so that we can be proud of what we do, we can look at ourselves in the mirror. And honestly, if people do feel good about what they do, they're going to be so much more effective. But there's the business imperative as well, isn't there? And I think, you know, you touched on acronyms like DEI and talking about ESG almost like initiatives, I suppose. And it's quite easy, and I'll choose my words carefully, it's quite easy for these things to become performative, siloed. And the way I might describe it is that I don't have a chief quality officer, or I don't have a chief testing officer, because testing is just part of business as usual. Quality is about business as usual. I don't have a quality problem. I don't have a testing problem. I don't have a chief diversity officer. Inclusion is about running the best business that we can be and making sure that everybody can show up and have their best day at work and being a business that we can all be proud of and that everybody feels that they can contribute to. So I don't see inclusion as optional any more than I see innovation as optional, culture as optional, quality as optional. I just can't really separate them, so they feel like the backbone of the business. So on one level, you can say, yes, we've not deviated from our path with respect to inclusion, but I just don't see how it can possibly be a question, a debate. It's like there's a wonderful photographer, Misson Harriman, who I think he was the first ever black artist photographer to shoot the cover of British Vogue. And he's been doing a lot of reportage recently. And one of his most famous pieces is a young woman at a protest with a T-shirt that says, "Why is ending racism still a debate?" It kind of blows my mind, all of this a little bit. So inclusion is just business as usual. And we want to feel good about ourselves. You know, this is to create positive impact, whether it's through philanthropy, sustainability, supporting social justice and economic freedoms. We want to have a really good footprint, a blast radius in everything that we do that we can be proud of. And it's self-fulfilling. It powers us on and makes us the business that we are. So, apologies for getting slightly Churchillian on you, but it's so important to how we work.
No, and listen, I think it's a conversation that many people are nervous about having in the current environment. And I think you've explained it extremely well, that it's just part of your business. It doesn't require, you know, in a sense, I feel bad talking about it, but I think we still do need to talk about it in this environment. And you also talked about, you know, it's very easy for it to become an initiative rather than something that really is
right,
part of the fabric of the business. Again, and maybe you don't want to talk about this, but if you're willing to, you are walking the talk here, because tell us about the London Living Wage.
The London Living Wage is feels like a bit of a no-brainer to me, but it's understanding that London is a really expensive place to live, and we're all fortunate. Everybody who works for Alpha has a strong degree of privilege, but we want to support the idea that London is an expensive place to be, particularly, of course, for essential services and people who don't have the luxury of working for a relatively successful software business. So it's important for us that we put our shoulder to the wheel there, and that we shine a spotlight on the fact that people need to be able to, frankly, survive in one of the most expensive cities in the world. It's the same as you might have noticed that myself and a few Alpha leaders spent a less comfortable night than usual, but didn't experience the of course, homelessness, because we were safe, we were wearing ski gear, and we knew we'd have a comfortable bed the next day. But it is important that we use the platform that we have within the business to shine a spotlight on social issues. And I would challenge anybody to debate with me some of these things, that homelessness is okay, not having the ability to live, not having enough money to get by. They're bullying. There's really no debate around them, and therefore we should shine a light on and use the platform we have as a business.
And the way you're shining a light, just for clarity, is you're paid the London Living Wage.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, again, at a personal level, you're a very well-paid CEO up until a number of years ago. Suddenly, you're taking the London Living Wage. I mean, was that a difficult decision to make?
Not really. I think it's important that the London Living Wage actually is more about a company-wide initiative on a personal level. Authenticity is important. So you look at what my job is, and my job is to do the best possible job for all of our stakeholders, and our shareholders are, of course, stakeholders. So as a business overall, we think it's very, very important to align with shareholders and align with common interest. So actually, in terms of one of the reasons we floated in the first place is to give colleagues access to becoming Alpha shareholders. So we do all sorts of things that that help colleagues have the same privilege that I do to be a shareholder of the business. And that means we're all aligned with shareholder interests. We're all trying to do something that is the best thing for our institutional shareholders. And for me, in order to be authentic, in order to get on board with that, then let's not have a big fat salary that I get irrespective. Let's make sure that the rewards I get are aligned with shareholder interests. And if the shares increase in value and we pay dividends out, that's how I get my reward. So it just feels like another way of being able to look in the mirror, because there's good alignment with stakeholders.
Fantastic. And look, I think it's great that you're shining a spotlight on this. And it kind of brings us into the third piece. And you know, I think your values, your own principles have come across as we've chatted today. But tell us a little bit more about your background. You alluded to being a software engineer in the past. Maybe just talk about how you ended up at Alpha.
It's definitely a story. I was brought up in Felixstowe, which you may be familiar with. It's in Suffolk. It's a very, very big container port. And virtually everybody in Felixstowe works at the port. When I was growing up, there was one other factory that people worked at as well, but definitely working class background. My father was from the Rhondda Valley. My mum was from Enfield, and that he was from a family of miners, and the only way to get out of that environment, because that's what he wanted to do, was to join the military, came out of the military, Metropolitan Police, found himself working in a factory in Enfield, and then was relocated to start this factory in the Felixstowe. So very much a working class lad. I liked my books when I was young. I liked my sport, and as we've discussed before, music, but absolutely a working class background. I was fortunate that there were still grants when I was a kid, because I'm not convinced I'd have been able to go to uni when I was a kid. But I was also sponsored by an organization after doing a bit of work experience, because I wanted to, would you believe, Richard, I wanted to be a marine biologist. And they said, fine, we'll sponsor you, but you need to do something that's useful for us. And I was fiddling around with a ZX Spectrum at home, so I thought, right, I'm a software engineer. So yeah, really, a few twists in the world. I'm not sure you'd have the same Andrew if I'd have gone down the marine biology path, and I might not have even have afforded to go to uni. Considering the amount of travel that I now do, I was slightly put off by this business I found myself working in after uni, that the way to advance is probably to go to Montrouge or Poitiers in France. So I thought, okay, I'll look for something else, and London felt like a very attractive thing. And I answered a couple of adverts, and one of them was for the then CHP Consulting. And I joined what is now Alpha as a software engineer. And as we talked about at the start, a lot of us have a very similar CV, that I did software engineering, then a bit of project management, had great mentoring and support from Andrew Page, one of our founders and still our chairman. Always supported my career really strongly, and noted that I seemed to have a sales bone in my body. So I was moved into sales, became sales and marketing director, chief operating officer, and I'll have my 10 years as chief exec next year. And being the chief exec of Alpha is the greatest kick any human can ever have. It's a phenomenal privilege, to the extent that I do lead them, to lead such a great group of people.
Is that something you would have always aspired to being a CEO? And was there sort of a moment in time where you thought, yes, I can do this, and this is the path?
It's a great question. You've had a great career yourself, and you know that it can be a little bit lonely. There's been a little chat actually recently, very recently, about I think Tim Cook, who is another wonderful example of somebody who walks the walk with respect to inclusion, by the way. He also shines a light on things, and talking about the mental health challenges of being a senior leader. I'm certainly not at Tim's level, but it can be a tough place, and you can feel the weight of the world on your shoulders. I'm somewhat suspicious of anybody who sort of grew up dreaming of being a chief exec. I think it's something that is handed to you, almost more of a calling. I remember the moment that Andrew said, "Okay, I'm gonna move to being chair. We're about to float. Here's the baton." And I genuinely didn't realize the weight of expectation and responsibility, because I was COO at the time. So it's only one letter, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it does feel like a big deal. I do take the burden very seriously, and you know, I work for a great company that's doing really well, but it can be tough. It really can be tough. And I'm lucky, actually. One of the things that we say to people is, make sure you check in, make sure that you talk to people. And the number of my colleagues who, however, are quite junior people, who every now and again will ask me, "Are you okay?" is really touching and phenomenal for my own.
I think COVID was in a bizarre way was very good for that. Maybe it was a learned behavior, but certainly I was at Dell at the time, and we were advised to talk to our teams. And the opening question was, "Are you okay?" And then the second question was, "No, are you really okay?" And I think we all realized that, you know, people on the surface may feel fine, but it's only when you really delve into it that a lot of people are struggling. And it doesn't matter what level in the company they're at. You know, we all respond differently to situations we find ourselves in.
Yeah, right. And I think you're completely right about COVID. It was transformational for us in many levels. And I feel it's tricky to talk about it in many ways, because it was an awful experience for millions of our fellow humans. You know, not a lot of fun for me. I don't live with my kids all the time, and I didn't really see them very much during that period. And obviously, that's a bit, being a father is a huge, huge part of what I am, never mind who I am. But what it did do is it did make us focus on communication and culture, as you've said. And I don't think many chief execs you talk to, Richard, would quote Lilo and Stitch. But I often say, well, whatever it is, Moana means family, and family means nobody gets left behind. And it's super important, particularly in a highly neurodivergent workforce, as most people have these days, I guess everybody has these days, to make sure that nobody is feeling lonely and locked away and not being checked in on. And I think if there is one thing that defines me as a leader, it's this word permission. And I feel so strongly that everything that you do as a leader gives permission to others, good or bad. I've cried at work. And if you cry at work, that gives other people permission to cry at work. If I commit some horrible microaggression to an LGBTQ+ colleague, it is literally giving other people permission to do that. by the role modeling good and bad that I'm doing. And if I'm checking in with people and receive a check-in very positively, then that gives permission as well. So that whole idea of leadership by giving permission is part of my own Tao. And I think that was put into sharp relief during COVID, as you say.
I guess giving people permission, you mentioned it yourself. It's good or bad, because if your behavior is bad, then it gives other people permission to do the same. So, you know, it puts you under a lot of pressure. You've talked about, you know, it's a mentally tough job. How do you relax? How do you deal with that pressure?
A quick point on that kind of pressure before I talk about how I deal with it. Authenticity is a word that you'll hear about when people talk about leadership a lot. And if you're inauthentic, not only will your colleagues, customers, industry friends sniff you out in a heartbeat, particularly your colleagues, but it puts pressure on you. And there's no one shape of leader. A colleague said to me once, I could never do your job. It would scare me to death. But the answer is, of course you could. You just probably need somebody who's got my attributes. The key thing is being authentic. And if you're inauthentic, you're kind of living a lie, aren't you? And that is a ludicrous pressure. And that segues into the mental health thing. Running a big business, or in my eyes, a big business, there is pressure to it. There is responsibility. But the responsibility I do not have is trying to maintain a persona, because the person that customers, colleagues, industry friends like yourself get is just shamelessly me. I bring my true self to work every day. That gives permission, of course, but I don't have the pressure of living a lie. I do need to relax, of course. I very much like doing nothing when I get the opportunity to. I like to hang out with my kids, family. I think everybody finds a thing, don't they? And I suppose my two things are music. I'm a big vinyl enthusiast. I listen to music to relax. I play hand percussion. I play the bongos, the djembe, the cajon, and the congo. I cannot drum normally. I can't do it with sticks, but I can play with my hands. Very much an amateur thing, but I do still retain that interest in DJing from back in the 90s. So I do all those things. And I like to lift up really heavy things, put them down again, and then do it again and again and again. And both of those things, apart from feeding my own personal vanity, both of those things are escape. And I think you just have to find your escape, don't you? There's a thing about weight training, that when you find your form, you don't really need to think about it. And it's a bit like running, I suppose, for me. You can just lose yourself in it. So those are my escapes. I like to try to do them as much as possible. And one of those has the added advantage of hopefully keeping me strong into my old age.
Indeed. And I like the way you got an Eminem allusion in there as well with Lose Yourself. Very, very good on the music.
That wasn't deliberate. So good spot.
But look, the final thing I'm going to ask you, and we've certainly gone over, but it's been such a fascinating conversation, is your social media presence is unusual, I would say, for a CEO. It features fur children, badgers, and T-shirts from the 90s. Why did you decide to do this? And did somebody tell you this is a great idea in marketing?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the most passive offensive compliments anybody's ever given to me was a competitor who said, you seem like such a nice guy on LinkedIn. Does anybody write your stuff for you? This is kind of weird. It was the dogs that came first, Richard. I think caveat is that my LinkedIn presence is very much me. There's obviously a lot of my personality is in line with Alpha's personality, otherwise I'd have a rough old time at work. So we talked about values earlier. Well, we'll stop short of politics, because a PLC can't have politics, but definitely there is a view within the business which aligns within my views. So I'll go a little bit further in shouting certain things out. It struck me that LinkedIn is a funny old place, isn't it? And it's become increasingly social. I heard that a lot of younger people are moving to LinkedIn because it's just a lot less toxic. So it's increasingly becoming less of a business network and more of a social network. But to the extent it is a business network, I thought it was weird that I'm doing stuff that I think is really quite important. Like, for instance, giving trading updates for a FTSE 250 business. Surely people will take an interest. It turns out they won't. So I thought, why don't I print off a little thing and give it to Georgie, my older Ridgeback, and just say alpha half year results. And I went from like 50 people engaging to 200 people engaging. So I thought, this kind of works. I live near some woodlands and there are badgers there. And I've set up a few wildlife cams. So I thought, okay, I'll suck people into engaging by putting some pictures of cute baby badgers playing around. And once I figured this out, and also figuring out the, let's say, the most likely age group of people in our business, where both you and I and Asset Finance Collective is trying to do as much as it possibly can to bring young talent into our industry. But I knew for a fact that if I wore a Roses t-shirt or a Wonder Stuff t-shirt, I'd get some engagement from people of my age, and I wasn't wrong. So yeah, it's an admission that if you just pump out information on LinkedIn, nobody engages. But if you put a doggy, or if you put a cute badger, or some music that people can empathize with, you get a bit more engagement. So yeah, sorry, it's a bit shameless, but it's also a bit of fun and a bit whimsical, isn't it?
Well, I'd certainly encourage any listeners, if they aren't following you or connected with you, they should, because the postings are fantastically enjoyable. And if you like, and this is the free of charge thing, I'm not going to see consultancy fees, I'd suggest, why don't you do some bongos on LinkedIn and post that maybe with the next results?
I will. I'll definitely keep that under consideration. I'm more shy than people think I probably am, but maybe you never know, you might get a DJ set or a little bit of bongo drumming out of me in the future.
Fantastic. Well, listen, first of all, it'd be remiss of me not to thank you for the sponsorship of these podcasts throughout 2025, but more importantly, thanks for your time today. Incredibly enjoyable. I've really appreciated the openness that you've shown, and it's been a great pleasure learning about Alpha, but also learning about you as a leader and learning about the culture of Alpha. So thank you so much for your time today, Andrew.
Well, thank you, Richard. You and I going back have never had a problem with chatting, so it's been a really pleasurable conversation. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Finance Connect, sponsored by Alpha Systems. Our podcast today was a lot longer than usual, but there was so much to cover with Andrew, and I didn't want to cut the conversation short. I particularly liked the discussion about values and how Andrew views this as a differentiator for Alpha. Every company talks about values, but in my opinion, they're often treated as a tick-the-box exercise rather than something that companies genuinely live by. I also really enjoyed the discussion on Andrew's own career and how open he was about this. At a time when there's lots of negativity towards wasteful practices in government and the public sector, his comment about a grant enabling him to attend university highlighted the positive impact that governments can provide, and specifically their role in supporting access to education for everyone. We'll have our final podcast of 2025 coming out just before New Year, so look out for that. In the meantime, enjoy the Christmas season, and thanks for listening.